Thank you for your support. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston on this September 10th. See, now I'm doing dates at the beginning of a show so I can figure out when the show was done. Very selfish of me. Just like to remind people that the last day to be properly registered for the general election is October 9th. It's sneaking up on us. It's technically less than a month now. So about 4.5 weeks, you can go to harrisvotes.com or votetexas.gov. Got the links on my website on every page every show announcement. And you can make sure you're registered properly, your ID matches the way your registration is styled, because you don't want anyone saying, you don't have the right to vote, you don't have the proper ID, because, you know, voter suppression is a thing. This is a call-in show, so the number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. I like to kind of run through some things that have caught my eye over the last several days and this morning, but you're not confined to that. It is open forum. So let's see, the first thing that caught my eye, it's hard to do them in any particular order. We are in the age of Trump. From CNN. U.S. to threaten sanctions against International Criminal Court and close the PLO office in Washington. Apparently, the Trump administration has decided that it wants to move against the International Criminal Court if it attempts to investigate, not even charge, but if it attempts to investigate the U.S. or Israel or its allies. According to an official familiar with planned remarks by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. Bolton will call for the protection of such allies, quote, by any means necessary, unquote, against the jurisdiction of the Netherlands-based court, which the U.S. does not recognize. This is kind of the core of it. The potential prosecution of U.S. service members in Afghanistan, and I will add, any other country in which they serve, is of primary importance to the administration, the official said. He's also set to announce closure of the PLO office in Washington, basically as an incentive to get them to negotiate peace with Israel. This is kind of an interesting story. On the one hand, they're really kind of following precedent. The U.S. has never been fond of having its nationals tried in foreign jurisdictions. Essentially, the feeling is that they can be used as political pawns. On the other hand, given the particular regime we have in power now, it can also sound a lot like what criminals do when they just disavow a court's jurisdiction. So, you know, this is the world we live in now. Let's see. Next thing, Trump's latest boast about the economy, surprise, surprise, isn't even close to accurate, by CNN. Donald Trump spent the morning bragging about the economy. At least one of his claims didn't come close to being true. The gross domestic product grew at an annualized rate of 4.2%. Now, annualized is an important word that they didn't include, I'm including. And it's higher than the unemployment rate of 3.9% for the first time, the president said, in over 100 years. Unfortunately, in the last 70 years, it's actually happened in at least 62 quarters, most recently in 2006. So, you know, just first liar. Democrats love Canada. Republicans, not so much. This is from the Toronto Star. Americans of all political stripes still like Canada, but Democrats are currently much fonder than Republicans, a new poll found. Pew Research poll, 63% of Democrats said their feelings toward Canada were very warm. Just 39% of Republicans said the same. I mean, there's more stuff there, but that's really interesting. There's some psychology at work there. And before I take, we've got two callers, Scott and Caleb. I'll just touch on one more story, and then I'll let you guys on. From Ford, Trump is wrong on asking them to build the Ford Focus in the U.S. Because of tariffs, it no longer makes economic sense for Ford to build the Ford Focus Active, which is an entry-level Ford, in China. Ford, as you may know, is going to be focusing on SUVs and pickup trucks. I think that that's a decision. Time will tell whether that is smart. In any case, with the tariffs, it's just too expensive. The price points won't work. And there's an individual by the name of Kristen, I'm not even going to come close to getting this name right, Zizek, Vice President of the Industry, Labor, and Economics Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan, along with other analysts, she said this trade thing turns into a whack-a-mole. You can shut off China, and things will come from India, Thailand, Taiwan, Poland, and Slovenia. Now, I have to tell you, from a geopolitical standpoint, I'm no Trump fan, God knows. But, you know, why help our potential adversaries build infrastructure? I'm much happier building these cars in Slovenia, Taiwan, Poland. Anyway, okay, so let's get to the first callers. We do have additional open lines, 713-526-5738. Scott, you are on the air. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. I've been reading some works of Milton Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suppose I might have in common with Milton Friedman?
You're Jewish?
No.
I
am not Jewish.
Your last name is Friedman?
No.
You're a conservative economist?
No. No, I think we're both somewhat skeptical. Both skeptical of claims about the public good.
How so?
Oh, I'm inclined to say that the public good depends on who's talking. One thing for the Medici, something else for Savonarola.
So, I guess I'm having a problem trying to figure what your point is here. So, are you saying there is no uniform understanding of public good, and therefore anybody doing anything can say that they're doing it in the public good, even if what they're doing the public considers horrible?
Well, I think practically everybody claims to be promoting the public good, but that's what they're but it depends on what they're promoting.
Well, I mean, I get your point that people with whom you disagree may still feel that what they are doing is a public good, even if a lot of the other public disagrees. And, I mean, that's why we have conservatives and liberals, right?
No.
And I get that. But I do think that there comes a point where what someone considers the public good is so far out of the mainstream that there is a consensus that it is no longer good for the public.
Oh, yeah, you could say that. You know, I do not believe that the public good requires marriage to be the union of one man and one woman.
Well,
I do not believe that the public good calls for criminalizing abortion. There's another faction of the population that believes that both are the public good.
Well, there's a faction of the population that believes snake handling is a way to worship God and figure out God's plan. I don't know that I would recommend that as a public policy.
You know, when I was a college sophomore, and that was 1960, a buddy in the dorm lent me a copy of Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society. And he thought Galbraith was socialist. I read it and I thought, well, he seems to have a broader view of the public good than I do. And it was about a year later that I joined Young Republicans, and I became a Democrat in 1967. And I found some interest that would satisfy, that I thought the Democrat Party was more likely to satisfy, or let's say I thought the Democrat Party was a better hunting ground for me.
Okay, Scott, I need to kind of wrap this up. Do you have a last word you want to put in?
Okay, well, one of my primary interests has been gay rights.
Okay.
The best I think I could argue on a public good basis is that it's part of me having a more tolerant and pluralistic country.
I agree. Okay, I got to let you go. Thank you so much for calling, Scott. I appreciate it. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. We have open lines, 713-526-5738. I'm sorry? I don't... Don is talking in my ear, and I just don't understand what he means.
No, you were going back to something. What were you saying?
I was going to do a station ID. And,
well, before that.
Before that, we were talking about public good.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why I said a little bit more meat on that bone.
Oh, you mean talking about what constitutes a public good?
Exactly.
Well, I think that Scott had a point, which is public good does depend on point of view. Assuming that people, I am going to assume, have assumed that at least initially, people run for public office because they want to do what they feel is the public good. I see we lost Caleb. Okay, Caleb, call back. You know, liberals have an idea of the public good, and a liberal idea of the public good is something like a strong labor movement so that workers can defend themselves, and things like perhaps single-payer medical care as a right, and a minimum wage that a person working a full-time job can support a family on without having to go to the public trough, which Republicans should resent. They should want companies to do their duty, if you will, and pay workers enough that the government doesn't have to essentially subsidize the company. I mean, it's a funny thing with Republicans. They have no problem with subsidizing companies. They don't want to subsidize people. Another funny thing is they have no they hate raising taxes, but they run deficits that raise interest rates. And they don't seem to have a problem with raising interest rates. It's really very paradoxical to me. I don't understand. But anyway, let me finish my station ID. KPFT 90.1 FM. You can help support KPFT by going to kpft.org. You can see what's going on in the station. You can get a schedule of various programs. Some programs have links that take you to websites that talk more about them. Mine does. You can also help support KPFT with actual money by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate thing and hopefully mentioning Think Wing Radio, so the money is at least sort of, you know, it's like, I like this show and that's why I'm giving money. It doesn't necessarily go to me. You can also help support KPFT by telling your friends. Tell your friends. If there are shows you like and that you feel they would be interested in, growing our audience base, word of mouth from you guys, that is a big, big help to us. That is almost worth as much as money. Also, you can go to my website, thinkwingradio.com. I generally archive shows there, some maybe better than others, but I think they're all interesting. I have links to all the stuff I talk about and stuff I never get to. You can also follow me on Twitter, at ThinkWing Radio. Okay, so we have open lines, 713-526-5738. Let's see. Talked about Ford. Okay, I don't normally do weather reports, but last I heard, Hurricane Florence is now a Category 4. It's likely to hit the southeast coast. They're talking about North, South Carolina, and maybe Virginia. Somewhere in there is the target zone. Keep in mind that that part of the country has a lot of barrier islands, and those folks are probably going to get hurt by wind, rain, and tides from the hurricane. So keep those guys in your thoughts, and when they are in need, do what you can to help. Florence has intensified rapidly. It's a life-threatening storm. Actually, between the time I started checking the news and the time I left the house, it had increased from a Category 3 to a Category 4. So all we can hope is that this doesn't turn into one of those slow-moving storms. This is kind of an interesting story. The U.S., I can't say started, but the U.S. is currently denying passports to Americans along the border, throwing their citizenship into doubt. Ah, I see Caleb is back. Okay, let me just finish this. During the reporting, okay, on paper, you've got a devoted U.S. citizen. He's an official American with a birth certificate showing he was delivered by a midwife in Brownsville at the southern tip of Texas. Spent his life wearing American uniforms, 3 years as a private in the Army, but Juan, 40, applied to renew his U.S. passport this year, and the government's response said they didn't believe he was an American citizen. And apparently this has to do with the fact he was born on the border from a midwife. There's a whole lot more to go to, but I will say this. I have a couple of friends that were neighbors of mine for many years, and they were down south of the they were down in the southern part of the country. Didn't intend to go to Mexico, but they ended up making a wrong turn, got on a road where there was no exit. They were forced to go to the border bridge, and there they were detained because they didn't have their passports with them. You know, it used to be just the driver's license was enough. Now you need a passport. I'm getting faces. You need a passport to go to Canada. You need a passport to go to Mexico. It used to be a driver's license. It was very easy. But they were detained for a number of hours before they were released and allowed to go back to the United States. So this is how crazy it's getting on our borders. Okay, 713-526-5738. We have open lines, and Caleb, you're on the air. Thanks for calling back.
Thank you. Hey, I had a question about the ICC, that International Criminal Court.
Yes.
I had heard that the reason the U.S. might disagree with sending people there is because they don't allow certain constitutional rights that American citizens normally are guaranteed.
That is an argument that is made. There's also the danger, the fear that American service personnel, even in just the normal performance of their duties, could end up being brought to that court, which is something that the U.S. as a policy does not like.
Okay. Well, I was in the military, and we're supposed to follow all international laws regarding, you know, combat, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a question. I don't know much about that court system. I guess I'll look up more about it later.
Well, I mean, I think we need an international court. I think that it would be useful if we have a problem with some of the rules and rights that maybe we should try to negotiate that so that we can agree with it. I think, for example, you know, if Cheney was a war criminal, he could be brought before that court. If Trump, for some reason, has committed international crimes, he could be brought before that court. And, you know, that's why, even though I agree with the principle of an international court, and even though I can understand how, as a normal part of policy, there are things the U.S. doesn't like having brought before the ICC, given this president, this regime, suddenly saying, reaffirming, really, that they don't want to participate in the international. It takes on a whole new flavor. You know, when you have a regime of criminals, potential criminals, alleged criminals, unindicted co-conspirators, you know, it takes on a whole new flavor when someone says, I don't recognize that court.
I understand entirely. I just had one more question, and I'll take it off air because I'm about to get back to work.
Okay. Your boss will appreciate that.
Does this court allow trial by jury? I'd heard that that's not a thing they do.
I do not believe that is a thing they do. I think they have a panel of judges.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll let you go. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you so much, Caleb, for calling back. Take care. Okay, we have open lines, 713-526-5738. There is something new at the New York Times. It's called Live from the Battleground Districts, Polls of the Key Races for House Control. The way the article goes, over the next 2 months, the New York Times will talk to more voters than ever before. It starts tonight, which in this case was September 6th. They'll publish the first Times Upshot Siena College polls of the most competitive battlegrounds. The twist is that the polls will be shown online in progress. They do it live. So, for example, you can actually see how many calls have been made, and you can see how many of those calls have turned into respondents. And this is a real-time thing, so you can see the numbers changing. It says they'll publish their results and display them in real time, start to finish, respondent by respondent. No media organization has ever tried this, blah, blah, blah. We intend to finish by November 4th, 2 days before the election. And they expect that they will have conducted nearly 100 live polls of the races most likely to decide control of Congress. The reason I bring this up, and the reason I have a link for it on my website, it's really kind of interesting to watch. There are things that are just kind of hypnotic. This is one of those. It's like you see these four or five or six races they're following in like Minnesota, Virginia, and you just watch the numbers turn, and you can watch the statistics on the surveys change. I have to say, for the most part, the Democrats are doing really well in these surveys so far. Now, keep in mind, these are not surveys like you get on Twitter or the internet, where they're not real surveys because all the participants are self-selected. These are, in fact, random surveys, which makes them statistically more valid. And then, of course, they have to go through interpretation. Before the interpretation, they're what you call raw data. Still have open lines, 713-526-5738. You may have heard about the Novichok assassination attempt and murders, because some innocent bystanders died, in Britain. And that the Brits believe they have found the two Russians who committed the crime. Apparently, Russian TV, according to polygraph.info, Russian TV may have cropped a photo in order to support a conspiracy theory. On September 5th, British authorities named two suspects in the Salisbury and Amesbury, and I don't know that I'm pronouncing that stuff right with, you know, British, the poisoning cases, and released photographs of two men. Among the materials released by the government were two separate photographs, one of each suspect, passing through a customs control corridor. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova appeared on the Russian talk show 60 Minutes, their 60 Minutes, on the state-owned channel Rossiya 24. She attacked the British evidence based on the photographs of the two men. With the photos of both men on screen in front of her, Zakharova pointed out that the time stamps on both photos were identical down to the second. She implied that it would be impossible for two men to occupy the same space at the same time. But internet fact-checkers quickly pointed out a problem with her detective work. It's clear the two men are walking in different but identical-looking corridors at the same time. While the surroundings are identical, the photographs were taken at slightly different angles, indicating different cameras in different positions. So what we have here is another example of obfuscation of the truth, news that actually is fake news. Now, the Trumpian definition of fake news is, I don't like what they're saying about me, therefore it is fake. The Russians, on the other hand, actually fake news. I used to listen to RT occasionally, or read RT occasionally, And what I found is that they're at least as bad as Fox News. When I say that, what I mean is they tell enough of the truth that it's hard to catch their lies. That makes them dangerous. I prefer my truth out in the open, and I prefer my lies not in the news. So, Russian news, man. I actually trust Chinese news more. They're at least really, really open about their bias. So it's not a lie. It's just, you know, it's pro-Chinese, just like our news tends to be pro-American. I can deal with that. But factually, they're not bad. Xinhua, or CCTV, I think CCTV4 is what they call it. Let's see. Open line, 713-526-5738. This was kind of an interesting story. Trump tweets a thank you to Kim Jong-un after the North Korean military parade. He responded, the president did, to news that the Pyongyang celebration did not include a display of nuclear missiles. Sent his thanks that they made changes to the military parade. Trump did. North Korea celebrated its 70-year anniversary with a show of military strength. But instead of missiles, they had floats and flowers. So Trump, of course, took credit for that. Turkey is going through some financial pinches. They blame this on the United States because Trump has ordered some tariffs. It says, the story from the Washington Post, and again, a link on my website for today's show announcement. 10 years after the worst financial panic since the 30s, growing debt burdens in key developing economies are fueling fears of a new crisis that could spread far beyond the disruption sweeping Turkey. Loss of confidence in the Turkish lira, which has lost 40% of its value this year, is only a preview of debt problems that could involve countries such as Brazil, South Africa, Russia, and Indonesia. Total debt in Turkey is $167 trillion, up from $97 trillion on the eve of the Great Recession. Oh, I'm sorry, I think that's global debt, not counting the United States. Global debt, am I just misreading this? Okay, few experts, I'm just going to read the paragraph before so I can make sure I get this right. Few experts think that a broader crisis is imminent, but the danger of a financial contagion that could hit Americans by crushing U.S. exports could send the stock market plunging and should be taken more seriously in light of a massive increase in global debt since the 2008 downturn. Total global debt is $169 trillion, up from $97 trillion in 2008. While previous debt crises involved U.S. households and later European governments such as Greece, this time the concern centers on companies in emerging markets that borrowed heavily. Now, there's a lot more to that story, but I think that segues nicely into national debt of the United States. As of July 31st this year, debt held by the public, U.S. debt held by the public, was $15.6 trillion. U.S. government debt, basically to itself, is $5.7 trillion. So debt held by the public was approximately 77% of GDP, gross domestic product, in 2017. That ranked 43rd highest out of 207 countries, which is high, but not unsustainable. The Congressional Budget Office forecast that the ratio will rise to nearly 100% of GDP by 2028. That, by the way, is very, very bad. As of December 2017, $6.3 trillion, or approximately 45% of debt held by the public, was owned by foreign investors, the largest being China. Now, I have a chart. And do we actually have a caller there, Don? Because I don't have a name. Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. All right, the largest holder of U.S. foreign debt is China. Now, people think of China as having like half of our foreign debt. Actually, as of May of 2018,
China held $1.2 trillion of U.S. debt. Then came Japan with $1.048 billion, Ireland with $301 billion, Brazil $299 billion, U.K. With $265 billion. So it's really spread out. And while China and Japan are by far the largest holders of U.S. debt, and certainly if they dumped their debt, it would hurt, the ratios are not what most Americans think. Taiwan actually holds a fair share of U.S. debt. They hold $165 billion in U.S. debt. You know what? I can continue this. Let me go ahead and do a station ID, and then I'll get to MOD. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. KPFT.org is how you support us. Go there, read, donate money, tell your friends. ThinkWingRadio.com is my website, and at ThinkWing Radio is how you follow me on Twitter. And MOD, you're on the air. How you doing?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Is it raining over there?
It was raining when I came in, but not heavily, just annoyingly.
It's supposed to be like this for a couple of days, I heard.
Yeah, actually, I was supposed to have an exterminator come in. Of course, he does the outside as well as the inside, and he said, it doesn't look like I can come for the next several days, so.
You don't want to waste your money then?
No, no. I mean, he could do the inside, but I actually have a feeling that the area outside is the source of my problem.
Yeah, I got.
I'm sorry. What was that, Don? Going out for what?
I don't know. A date, coffee. What are we doing?
Oh, I got business to do after I leave here, man.
Oh, okay, I'll just.
I got yeah. Without the exterminator coming, I have plans B, C, and D, so I'm good. I'm sorry, MOD. So what were you going to say?
No, I just want to say hi. I don't want to get you mad at me, Mike.
I don't get. When have I gotten mad at you?
It's been a while.
It's been a while. I mean, when have I gotten mad at anybody?
I don't think you. You know, I'm joking.
I know you are. I mean, I know you're not literally saying I get mad at you, but I think for the most part, I keep my emotions pretty much in check, and I think I try to be civil to everybody, even when I fundamentally disagree with them.
Well, you got probably a very. Not you don't probably you do have a very well composed demeanor.
Thank you. I work at it. It doesn't come naturally.
Well, you're letting me talk for the last couple of years has helped me too learn how to stay focused, more focused, and also.
I think you've done immensely better, and I'm really proud of you.
It was because of you.
I thank you.
Yeah, it has been. Do you want to talk about the China debt thing, or you want?
We can take a minute or two on that. I think it's an important topic.
Okay, I was going to. Think about fake news, but we can go off the rail on that one. And
well, I think the important takeaway from the Chinese the U.S. debt that China holds is that the number is significant, but it isn't remotely what it is in the public consciousness.
Right. So in 2015, maybe before then, China started regulating their markets. They quit IPOs. They started jailing grandma day traders. They started imprisoning CEOs that were inside trading or CEOs attempting to offload major shareholdings of their companies. So they actually started regulating their markets about 4 years ago. And at that time, that's when they had over $2 trillion. They had like $2 trillion in one. $2.1 trillion, and now we're down to, what do you say?
About one, well, it's about 1.2.
Yeah, so I called the past, I mentioned that they had dumped half the U.S. T-notes, junk bonds, debt, toxic, whatever you want to call it, which is people usually do when they invest in a country that is like America, to acquire them by quantitative tightening, which is get rid of debt and acquire hard assets, and that would be real estate and businesses, which they have been doing from AMC theaters to Ship Me Donuts.
Not to mention pork.
Yeah.
They've actually come close to cornering the market on pork because they bought one of the largest U.S. pork processors.
Right. So if they're getting rid of their debt by acquiring hard assets, and in the 2012 budget bill that, you know, it had to be signed by Elizabeth Warren, Merrill Lynch is $42 trillion of toxic debt, which, you know, Merrill Lynch is owned by Bank of America. And Bank of America got this Congress, including Elizabeth Warren, she had to sign off, to include that as what's known as, what, FDIC, U.S. Citizen Insured, you know, like the U.S. Citizen Insures.
Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Is that what you're talking about?
Thank you. So if you put that, I'm trying to paint a picture as you're doing very good as far as the general populace's concept of what that means, right?
Well, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and there's something similar for securities, it's worth noting it used to be a deposit guarantee of $100,000. Many years ago, it was increased to $250,000. So your deposits with a bank, and I'm saying this in a very specific way, your deposits in a bank totaling up to $250,000 are guaranteed by the federal government. For those few of you who have more than $250,000 in banks, and there are reasons why you wouldn't want to do that necessarily, but if you do, if you have like multiple deposits, let's say three deposits and each one has $250,000, so you have a total of $750,000, the FDIC will cover up to $250,000 of your bank deposits, which is why if you have that much money, you need to divide it among banks, not just accounts.
Yeah, I think that is another conversation we'll go into about banks.
We should have more of that problem, by the way.
That we should have regulation back, Mike. That's the bottom line. Because
absolutely,
there's a law that's been passed that banks are not allowed to go insolvent. And that's, you know, that's another conversation. But
yep,
this is like 3 or 4 year old statistics. I read it that, you know, you have a quadrillion, and that's hard to get your hands around. But that's
it's hard to get your hands around a trillion.
Okay.
You remember we were discussing a billion that you could give away $1 million a year, and it would take you 1,000 years, and that assumes that you're not getting any yield on it.
Okay, so a quadrillion is 1,200 trillion. Get that around, get your hands around that.
A quadrillion is a trillion with three extra zeros, right?
A trillion, yep. So it's actually 1,200 trillion. 1,200 trillion.
Okay.
That's what a quadrillion is.
All right.
And when I looked at this stuff and I was, you know, reading this more so 3 years ago, this is 3 years old, that over, I would say, two-thirds of that is what's been considered non-hard commodities. In the global market, there was a lot of trade, a quadrillion. This is a three-year-old stat or amount.
I think I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up because
more
I think
than
we're getting a little amigo here.
Okay, more than two-thirds of that quadrillion are fuzzy commodities like put options, plays, toxic derivatives. And that's what fed the global markets when Hank Paulson said these CDOs, CDS is quiet, credit default swaps, credit default options, these plays, these puts, these toxic derivatives are now legal instruments.
Well, puts and calls are legitimate hedges for certain things, for business. I mean, it makes sense to have puts and calls, the right to sell at a price, the right to buy at a price. Derivatives are just things that kind of muck stuff up. We do have open lines. Thank you, MOD, for calling. Open line 713-526-5738. I have a note that a caller wanted the source of the debt information I used and what it really means. That's a great question. I actually once corrected the Houston Chronicle on this very topic. There is a difference, a major difference, between talking about the deficit and talking about the debt. And many people do not understand the difference and use them interchangeably. The deficit is whatever during a particular budget fiscal year is the difference between how much money you have and how much money you spend. So just to keep the numbers sort of a little more intelligible, let's say the government spends $100 billion, but tax revenue is $90 billion. So at that point, the deficit is $10 billion. That deficit gets added to the national debt. Technically speaking, the national debt is all the debt the U.S. government has incurred from the founding of the nation, from 1781, I believe it is. Technically, now, there have been times when we have been in surplus. There have even been times when we've managed to clear out the debt, but that was a long time ago. But the national debt is all the money that the government has borrowed over all time, whatever it hasn't paid back, and that number can either grow or shrink. So, for example, during the Bush years, the first Bush, his budget was laboring under the enormous debt that was incurred under the Reagan administrations. And it got to a point where between the amount of debt and the interest rates on that debt, about 25% of the budget was debt service. Interest. 25% of the budget was debt service. Now, to some extent, we grew out of that because the economy grew, the dollar inflated slightly. During the latter part of the Clinton years, we actually were running surpluses, so we were actually chipping away at that debt. And the less, if you have any experience paying your credit cards when you owe money, you know that the best investment you can make is paying down your debt. So if you're paying $500 a month and the minimum payment is $400 a month, every month that $500 pays down more debt than it did the month before. On the other hand, if you are constantly running personal deficits so that the amount of debt that you have on your credit card increases, your monthly payment is going to increase, and you're never going to dig yourself out from under. When the Republicans passed this enormous tax cut that is primarily for the rich, I actually asked my accountant, for me, it's going to look like an increase. I'm not rich enough. So what's going to happen is the national debt is going to grow, estimated, unless something changes, at the rate of about $120 billion a year over the next 10 years. So at the end of 10 years, we'll have an extra couple of trillion dollars in debt. Now, imagine that on your credit card. That means your minimum payment every month, which is what the U.S. pays, we pay a minimum payment mostly, goes up every month. You're not chipping away at your debt. What the U.S. does is we sell bonds. And those bonds finance the debt. So, for example, China, out of our total debt, which I think now is something like $24 trillion, I think it's in that neighborhood, China, as of May of this year, holds a little under $1.2 trillion. So they have about 5% of our debt. That's enough to shake up the market if they were to dispose of any or all of that debt. But it's not like it would bring the country crashing down. That would take a very, very concerted effort from a lot of countries. Now, the more people that want to buy our debt, the lower the interest rates we can charge. Interest rates go up when countries or individuals perceive greater risk and are not as enthusiastic about buying U.S. debt. In order to attract them, the government the Treasury has to raise the interest rate. So this goes back to, as our national debt increases relative to our gross domestic product, our GDP, it becomes harder for us to pay. It's like, it's at a certain point on your credit card, you can't make the minimum payment anymore. That's kind of what investors begin to fear might happen to a country like the United States. At a certain point, the debt becomes unsustainable. So in order to attract those investors, you have to raise interest rates. And that's why when the deficit increases, interest rates go up. I mean, there are relationships here that you can actually sort of grasp that make the whole process a little less mysterious. I mean, we can talk about this. We can talk about other stuff. We have open lines. The number is 713-526-5738. Okay, this was kind of an interesting article that I ran across just a couple of days ago. It was from Vox.com, and it's entitled, What I Learned About Weight Loss from spending a day inside a metabolic chamber. It's a relatively long article, and I've just sort of picked out some pieces. And this may seem self-evident. When scientists offer mice or rats a spread of junk food, they consistently find that only some overeat and, to use their term, puff out into little rodent blimps, while others maintain a normal size. They have to be cute to make people read the story. A similar thing happens in people. In the U.S. and around the world, we are now overwhelmed with highly palatable, cheap calories. Basically, sugared treats, salty treats. If you look at the food labels, almost everything has salt and or sugar. And if you try to eat healthy and buy stuff with little or no salt or sugar, you discover that it tastes so bad that you end up having to add salt or sugar. That's just human nature. So this has helped obesity rates to soar because food tastes better, so you tend to eat more of it. But not everyone overeats and becomes overweight, and not everyone who becomes overweight develops illnesses like diabetes or heart disease. And this individual variation is one of the greatest mysteries of modern science. In reality, you know, you talk about metabolism boosters, slow metabolism, fast metabolism. Metabolism is actually thousands of chemical reactions that turn the energy we eat and drink into fuel. And the body is constantly making micro adjustments. There are several predictors of how fast or slow a person's metabolic rate will be, which include lean muscle, fat, the kind of fat, whether it's white or brown. This I have learned from my wife, who does research. Having a higher metabolic rate means that your body uses food for fuel instead of storing it as fat, but you can still gain weight if you consume more calories than your body needs. And this was interesting. It has been found that people exposed to cold temperatures while they sleep, so you guys that are arguing over how cold the bedroom gets at night, keep this in mind. Cold temperatures while you sleep causes you to accumulate more brown fat, which is a fat tissue whose main function is heat production, and that brown fat burns more calories. I know from my readings that you can, as they say, you can brown white fat. In other words, brown fat can be converted to white fat, which then makes it easier to be consumed. So that's the metabolic thing. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. KPFT.org is how you support the station. You can read, you can donate, you can find out about shows and hosts. You can also follow me on thinkwingradio.com, which is my blog, where I have show announcements, links to all the articles, and then some that I use on the show. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at thinkwingradio. So, Don, I have actually now gone through more material than I expected. So, let me ask you, what are your thoughts on some of the news of the day?
On the news of the day, I don't know. I truthfully don't have any thoughts right now. I've been busy, so I don't know all of the news of the day. You, of course, you bring in the news that nobody else is talking about. So that way where, you know, of course, people are going, okay, what is he talking about? As far as like China's, the way their economy is set up, a lot of people don't know that China's economy is set on how many houses they build. So it's a very dangerous thing because a lot of their homes that they're building, it's
don't have buyers,
and they have no buyers. So it's really a dangerous thing that they're doing, especially when we're borrowing money from them. The same way our housing market burst, if their housing market burst, we are in some trouble.
There, I'm glad you brought that up. That's something that actually bears some speaking. We have had real estate bubbles, and we know how bad they can go. China is building into a real estate bubble. There are literally entire small cities that have been built by speculators that are empty. You add this to the thing that I've been bringing up for a long time, that because of China's one-child policy going on for decades, and to some extent, even though it's not enforced so much anymore, people are still in the habit of having one child, they are set for a demographic crash where they're going to have a much smaller population of young people to work and pay into retirement plans, and they're going to have a much larger population of old people who will need support, who will be unable to support themselves or only support themselves partially. It's sort of like our Social Security situation where we have a baby boom and a baby bust, and now we're going to have some issues with that, except in China it's going to be much, much worse. We at least have immigration, which for us is a good thing because it helps to pay Social Security for the rest of us. They don't have immigration. They're just going to have a demographic crash. So you not only have too many housing units for the existing population, you're going to have way too many housing units for what they have planned for as a shrinking population. The population in China right now is something like 1.3 billion people. It's about 20% of the world population. And they are targeting, like by the end of the century, maybe even by the middle of the century, to have something like 750 million people. And, you know, in principle, that's a good thing because it's less stress on the land, it's less consumption, it's less waste, it's less debris, it's less trash. But it will be the biggest demographic experiment in human history, short of the Black Death in Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries.
When did China start getting cars?
Start getting cars?
Yeah.
Whenever
they started expanding, because I know China, China right now is buying air from Canada in cans because
you can't breathe.
Yeah, because you can't breathe.
Yeah, the air pollution is so bad.
Yeah, and the way their houses are built, it's no insulation or anything like how ours is. It just goes through the window.
Building standards, I've been there, and building standards are poor at best.
Yeah, so that's one of those things that China, because they were talking about India and the way India is going through this phase of trying to grow as a country, but even as they grow as a country, they're scared to become China, where they grow so fast, so big, all these cars are on the road, no actual...
People in India than China.
Yeah. But
the population of China, of India, is actually larger, smaller country. In China...
Well, what does smaller country mean? Because certain
less
parts
land area.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And India also in the northern part is more mountainous. It does get rain. China in area is bigger than the United States. A lot of it is desert, as is a lot of the United States. So most of this population of like 1.3 billion, most of it is along the coast, which is where most population in most countries tends to be, along coasts and rivers.
So India being smaller, of course, they're at 1.225 billion. China's at 1.338 billion. And we are at 309.3 million.
100 million.
As far as people?
Yeah, we're at 300 million. 309 million.
That's what I thought I said. But yeah. That's as of 2016, so of course.
I think we're up to like 320 now.
Yeah, we have another census coming up in 2020, I believe.
Yeah, that's a political football.
Yeah, which is, of course, going to change up the way they do our redistricting and everything else. So good luck with that.
Well, Democrats have to win. Democrats have to win because that's one way to deal with gerrymandering. That's why. I mean, when we lost in 2010, I knew it was going to be a catastrophe. So we have to win in 2018. So... And also in 2020, of course, so that the census is controlled, if not by Democrats, at least by neutral parties, and take control away from partisan Republicans. Let me get to Gary. Gary, you're on the air. How you been?
Hey, Mike. Okay, I've been listening, haven't called, but I wanted to let you know that you owe me a beer, and
how so?
I owe you a beer, so we'll go out and have a beer.
I mean, I don't mind that, but why do we owe each other beers?
Because about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, we were talking about Donald Trump, and there was all this insinuation that he was a liar and a crook and a thief and a criminal and a tax evader and all this stuff about Russia, but we kind of came to the conclusion that he was flat out nuts. Well, now the cat is out of the bag. We got the Woodward book. We got all the insinuations of people calling him bleeping morons and bleeping idiots.
So we were right.
Toddler in chief. And now Elizabeth Warren has publicly called for the invocation of the 25th Amendment, which is means that somebody is not fit for office. In
now,
other words, deranged.
When did that
so
happen?
We hit the nail on the head, dude.
When did that happen? Because when I
yesterday,
left the House...
Yesterday.
I didn't see it in the news.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that is not mentioned by the 25th Amendment, or not mentioned when people talk about it, everyone talks about it has to be invoked by the vice president and half of the cabinet. Alternatively, the Congress can invoke the 25th Amendment.
Right, but with the, all these insinuations about people on his own staff and in his administration working around him, I think it's only a matter of time. Because if not, then all these people will never work again. I tell you, Sarah Sanders is never going to get hired again as a spokesman for
I like the way she's adopted his language, and she doesn't just say the New York Times. She says the failing New York Times.
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's so obvious. You know, that's the difference between a liar and a pathological liar.
A
liar is trying to sell you a used car, and he'll tell you, knowing full well, that this car was not owned by a little old lady who kept it in a garage for 10 years. A pathological liar will tell you that this car can turn into a boat, and if you go down to the office, you can get wings so it can fly. They have no attachment with reality, and that's what everyone has finally realized. Trump is not lying.
He is not...
dealing with reality.
As I understand the definition of a pathological liar in lay terms, a pathological liar is someone who will tell a lie even when the truth would serve as well.
Exactly. And it's called, you know what the study of pathology is? It's the study of disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's called pathological, not a compulsive liar, not a regular liar, not a dirty liar, not a, you know, some guy in a casino liar. It's a pathological liar because it's a mental illness. It's an inability to distinguish when a lie is or is not required. All right? And he can't help it. I think the Washington Post has compiled a list of about 17 pages of daily lies, like today on Twitter.
Yeah, Gary, the music is playing, so we're going to have to wrap this up in
all
like
right,
2 seconds.
All right, so I like Heineken. See you later.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. All right, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. Thank you, Don, for all the work you do. And I'm going to end with a quote that I really wanted to read last week but didn't have time. And this is the quote from the Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Strong, responsible unions are essential to industrial fair play. Without them, the labor bargain is wholly one-sided. The parties to the labor contract must be nearly equal in strength if justice is to be worked out. And this means workers must be organized and that their organizations must be recognized by employers as a condition precedent to industrial peace. And that is the show. Have a great week. I'll be back next Monday. Bye-bye.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved. Get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not. Nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.
Join us on Sunday, September 23rd, when Deadbeat presents Thanks, Jerry, a concert benefiting 90.1 KPFT. Through this transitive nightfall of diamonds, the music of Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead will be celebrated by 9 different artists. From acoustic solos and duos to full-on hell-raising electric collectives, some of Houston's finest musicians will lay down tunes for your ears to swallow and your mind to digest. The event takes place at Bubba's Sports Bar and Grill, located at 6225 Washington Avenue. Doors at 3 p.m., musical start around 4. The show features Charles Bryant, Jack's Last Straw, Star Jernigan, Atomic Space Patrol, the Dogman Acoustic Band, Little Outfit, Mariana Sokol, Jess Schneider, and Premium Blend. A door raffle and silent auction will accompany the cold libations and great food available at this family-friendly venue. A $20 donation is requested. Come early, stay late. Two stages will provide nearly continuous